Lebanon to Hermitage, Altoona to Bloomsburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, in a landmark ruling, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has decided that skill games are in fact slot machines and subject to state gaming laws. David Taylor, Rebecca Euler, and Stephen Bloom are here with a Capital Watch analysis. And it appears once again the state budget will not be finished by the June 30th deadline. Is it time to go back to two-year budget cycles? I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. In somewhat of a mixed ruling, Pennsylvania Attorney General Dave Sunday's office has concluded that the law does not allow for public funding of construction on private residences. This after the Commonwealth spent over $1 million on security upgrades to Governor Josh Shapiro's private residence in Montgomery County. State Treasurer Stacey Garrity had refused to pay the bill, saying there was no legal basis for the expenditures. While agreeing with Garrity's position, Sunday's office did allow for a one-time payment of the construction costs, citing extraordinary circumstances. Those extraordinary circumstances are last year's firebombing of the governor's official residence in Harrisburg and an attempt on Shapiro's life. The AG's office stressed the need for the legislature to update the law related to such expenditures. Here is an interesting idea. State Representative Natalie Mihalik of Allegheny County is proposing that there should be consequences for the state budget being late. She plans to introduce legislation that missing the deadline would trigger a special election for lawmakers who failed to conclude the constitutionally mandated task on time. Mihalik says her proposal is designed to bring about a meaningful way to hold legislators accountable for their budget failures. The Three Mile Island nuclear plant in Middletown, Pennsylvania, is now on track to resume operations next year. Constellation Energy owns the currently shuttered facility, which will now reopen to provide electricity for data centers operated by Microsoft. The energy consumed by data centers has fueled public opposition to their construction from residents fearful of it triggering rising electric rates. Microsoft has sidestepped that issue by striking a deal to reopen Three Mile Island to provide for its energy needs. Similar plans to open a major data center in Indiana County will include an on-site natural gas-fueled electric generating plant. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. There are over 70,000 skill game machines in Legion halls and businesses across Pennsylvania. The state Supreme Court has now ruled that they are slot machines and therefore subject to state gaming laws. The impact of the ruling is substantial. To sort through the dynamics, David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation for a Capital Watch discussion. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your Capital Watch All-Stars from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, President and CEO Rebecca Euler. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
It's great to be back again, David. Thank you.
And my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, thanks so much for being on the show.
I am happy to be with you, David. Thank you.
Well,
and you, Rebecca, as well.
It's great to have the team together here, and wow, things just keep happening. And so the latest thunderbolt to land in the middle of our state public policy deliberation is that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania has ruled that the so-called skill game machines are in fact gambling devices, which means that they are not legal and that they may not be used until and unless the General Assembly passes a law permitting them to be used. So as one of the potential named revenue sources that Governor Shapiro had put forward, it's looking like that might actually come to pass now.
Think about the whole idea of a sin tax. This is a commonly used
right.
description for taxes of things that the society as a whole determines to be in some fashion bad.
Right. And don't so approve
the,
of it.
The thought is, and I think just to help sort of reflecting on our whole conversation today, there's a strange thing that happens with these sin taxes. Like the government tends to be, they have identified something bad. They say, stop it. They make a law against it. And then they say, well, you know, while we're doing all that, let's just maybe go ahead and figure out how we could legalize and tax it and share in that revenue. And then it suddenly is no longer a sin tax. It's just a tax on a thing that the government is willing to play ball on.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is kind of the typical pattern. And we've seen it over the years with alcohol prohibitions and gambling prohibitions and technology prohibitions. And even now that the data centers and the pipelines, so many even important industries are affected by this mindset of government. We can say it's bad. We can threaten to shut it down and ultimately draw from that a way to say to these companies, if you let us play ball with you and get a share of the revenue, you can do it after all.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of that going on here in the background.
There absolutely is. And Pennsylvania is very over-reliant on revenue from those kinds of sources. And the thing that troubles me about that, and you've heard me say this before, is that wherever there is an activity where the Commonwealth gets a piece of the action, whether it is the state stores or the state lottery or the slot machines or probably in this case now these skill games machines, inevitably the Commonwealth becomes an encourager of whatever that activity
thing.
Is.
Yes.
Yeah. So the thing that was supposedly at the outset was bad, that not only does it become normalized, but actually that the state government itself becomes a cheerleader so that they can get more revenue from that. Quite a paradox.
Yeah, and I think we saw that most recently with the expansion of online gaming, casino gaming online, because I just looked at the numbers for the Gaming Control Board just out of curiosity. Let's see how gaming's been doing recently, because I know the casinos are arguing that these skill games are competing with them, so they're affecting their income. Well, if you look at gaming revenues over the past couple years, they've exploded.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason for that is because of online gaming. That's where they've exploded. So I think to you guys, to your point that you're making, is that the state has come to terms with the fact that we're allowing this now, including online, which is now permitted, and they're making a heck of a lot of money off of it.
I say this all the time. I hate having to be that guy, but apparently this is my role in life, is to be that guy. The issue with the online sports betting in particular is troubling to me because it is so ubiquitous among especially young men that apparently every young American man between 18 and 30 has a sports gambling app on his phone. And that here you have what is essentially, it's a drain. It's empty. It's something that adds no value economically, and that you have young men losing, you know, however much of their earnings to this wasteful kind of activity. And you think, well, where should their energies be directed? Like, shouldn't you be saving for a down payment on a house or paying off the money you owe on your car or any of these other productive things that would put people further ahead in life? And instead, they're gambling it away. So, I don't want to be the person who like stands in judgment. I think that it's always a mistake to tell people that they can get something for nothing. Like, that's inherently a bad thing to teach people.
But yet now we have state revenues really dependent on that.
Right.
I mean, is what we're talking about here.
Because we
so this is going farther down that
yes,
path.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I just, again, I know we don't live in a perfect world, never have, never will, but in a better world, we would only have as much government as we absolutely need, and then only assess taxes to the extent that we would need to pay for that much government, and then stop and leave everything else to individual people. But because doesn't it seem as though that government thinks that everything exists for the purpose of being taxed? that like we're going to have a tax on digital advertising. Why? Well, just because it's there.
We can get it and it sounds good. It'll get votes. It'll be popular with our constituents for whatever reason.
What role does state government play in digital advertising? None. Like, what burden does it put on the Commonwealth that has to be administered or regulated? With like almost nothing.
And that's almost worse, because I believe what they're proposing there is an excise tax, which is like the worst kind of tax, because those are buried underneath layers of administration that the consumer can't see that they're paying it.
Mm-hmm.
Excise taxes are just, I think, insidious taxes, because you don't know that you're paying it because it's buried underneath other charges.
Yes.
So it proliferates throughout the economy. So they're just the worst kind of tax.
And this is along the same lines of let's decide exactly how much government we need. Let's only tax the economy to the extent that we need to pay for that stuff, but also let's make it transparent to
visible.
Everybody exactly what that burden of government
right.
is, so that we can all see it objectively and make that part of our ongoing decision-making process. But what's also interesting, getting back to this thing with the skill games, that listeners to previous programs would have heard us talk about how the skill games industry attempted a coup against the Pennsylvania Senate Republican majority by putting up stooge candidates against Republican incumbents in heavily GOP districts to try to knock off those folks and put in a bunch of new people who would be completely beholden to that particular industry. The skill games people lost all of those races. And so, again, I would think that perhaps the appetite of at least of the Senate Republican majority to lock down hard on that industry, it might not be too difficult to persuade them to do that.
Well, and lawmakers really have been talking for years about this industry and how to tax it, but they haven't been able to come to an agreement on what that tax rate or the level of regulation should be. So this forces the issue. So this decision by the Supreme Court the other day absolutely gives them a deadline. They gave them a deadline of October to either pass a law that regulates and presumably taxes the industry, or these skill games become illegal, period. So this is a deadline. So if they're going to do it, they have to come to an agreement.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation. So, yes, we are in the midst of the budget zone. We're here in the month of June. The budget is supposed to be done by the end of June. I don't think anybody expects that to actually come to pass with the time that we have left. And certainly it's also the gubernatorial election year, electing every member of the state House, half the members of the state Senate. So there's going to be a lot of conflict, a lot of back and forth. But this last week, and Steve, I want you to weigh in on this, this last couple of days have been really kind of, I don't know what the right word is. It's surreal, perhaps, where the fanaticism of House Democrats against any kind of educational choice or alternative for students whose families don't believe they are served well by their zip code-based school district. Like, the House Democrats are on a jihad. What's going on?
I mean, I can't say that I understand what's going on, but I can tell you that there's a bill that's been introduced. It's House Bill 2632, and without getting into all the details, it would be a crushing blow to school choice educational opportunity in Pennsylvania. It attacks specifically Pennsylvania's EITC and OSTC programs, which are the original OG school choice plans from back around 2001. They started here in Pennsylvania, gradually grew. They've just celebrated their 25th anniversary of helping kids get a leg up out of a failing school or a school that just isn't right for he or she and their family. And so this has been nationally recognized. The recent federal school choice program is actually modeled after Pennsylvania's original program. And everyone across the board, at least many people across the board, have been, how did you guys do that in Pennsylvania? Such an important thing, and you've got it. And how can we get that in our state?
Right.
Meanwhile, the democratically controlled House of Representatives is fast-tracking this bill. In the last several days, it came from introduction to committee passage, and now awaiting a potential vote as soon as Monday on the House floor on final vote, on third consideration. So this is one of those, okay, they're going for it with all they got. We've got to try to do everything we can to educate Pennsylvania citizens and lawmakers as to why a bill like this is so damaging and really that they've got to speak up. Like, we've got to stop this thing.
So again, to remind the listeners that in the House of Representatives, there are 203 members, and the current composition is 102 Democrats to 101 Republicans. And although it's only a one-seat majority, House Democrat leadership has been exceptionally disciplined in holding the caucus together and making everybody walk the plank together to pass the agenda. There are many Democrat lawmakers, especially urban lawmakers, whose constituents make use of these programs, rely on these programs, are families that are very dissatisfied with the incumbent public school, especially the Philadelphia City School District. And I mean, if Leader Bradford brings this to a vote, I'll be very surprised if all of those lawmakers walk the plank and vote to defund the scholarships that their constituents make use of.
Yeah, and it's frightening. It's, of course, you know, us as Pennsylvania citizens, we're not prevented from weighing in and jumping into the fray. And if anyone's listening who wants to find out how to get involved, Commonwealth Foundation has a lot of details on our website. There are ways you can reach out to your lawmaker, text message your lawmaker to make sure they know how important this is. It really matters across the entire state. Like, the entire legislature needs to be aware of the risk here and take the appropriate action while there's time.
Yeah. Well, and it's not the only assault on alternatives that was launched at that very committee meeting, that the public virtual schools, even though they've been subjected to budget cuts for 2 years in a row, that another third, even steeper round of cuts against the virtual schools, which already receive less money per kid just right out of the gate. It really seems punitive. It seems as though the education establishment, whatever you want to call it, that they want to wipe out these alternatives, and that the virtual schools in particular, they want to do two things. Number one, continue to cut their funding to put these schools on a path to starvation. And number two, to also suffocate them with busy work regulatory compliance that they are not putting on the conventional school
systems. And included in the bill we were talking about with reference to the EITC, OSTC scholarships, it's going to require audits and careful financial investigations and all that are not forced on public schools in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So again, a disproportionate response, putting the more vulnerable schools that are outside of the taxpayer funding stream as compared to students who are relying entirely on the tax revenues of the state, and somehow we're choosing to punish one of those groups for nothing just because we don't like the way they're getting their educational dollars as a matter of philosophy. Not they're following the law, in other words, but they're being intimidated for even following the law.
Right, and it's unrelated to student satisfaction, family satisfaction, unrelated to educational achievement and progress for students. Students who, the reason why parents and students wanted something different was because whatever was on offer at the zip code-based public school was insufficient for them. It did not meet their needs. The overarching principle here needs to be the purpose of public education is so that the public is educated. It's not about any kind of specific structure or any means to an end. The end is that our citizens are literate, numerate, are capable of independent thinking and problem solving, and that it prepares them, that this experience prepares them for success in life, I would argue, including success in the workplace. And somehow we've gone from a country where, like in 1900, the United States achieved 90% literacy with McGuffey readers and one-room schoolhouses. And here we are in Pennsylvania spending $24,000 per kid per year, and we have less than 30% of kids that are actually proficient in English and math. So, like, the point of education should be that our citizenry is educated. It's not about worship of a particular structure or bureaucracy or power interests that control those entities. So this is all just really infuriating, in my opinion.
It's an unnecessary battle. I mean, to start the budget process out by using so much of the assembly's clout and influence to intimidate and really prevent students from getting access to the types of schooling that they and their families have determined work best for them. It's so absurd. It's like, why would you turn on this group of people? They're perfectly deserving Pennsylvania citizens trying to utilize programs that have existed for a quarter century to improve their educational success, and they're now being frightened that they're not going to have that anymore.
Yeah. Again, it's our politics is distorted. Our politics has the wrong kind of incentives behind it. And I don't know where this ride is going to stop. I really don't. Because insofar as that there had been a consensus, the consensus that was built over time was that this program, which is funded through voluntary contributions, the donors, you know, get a tax credit, but I mean the funding comes from voluntary contributions. One of the people who was in support of that back in the day was State Representative Dwight Evans of Philadelphia, and of course State Representative Evans went on to be Congressman Evans, and that Dwight Evans is now concluding a long and distinguished career in the U.S. House as well. And I just, how can it be that someone who's as much of a Democrat stalwart as Congressman Evans, that the world could change to such a degree because he was for that program because it served people in his Philadelphia community who were not satisfied with just the local public school. Anyway, I guess that's one of those, what do you call them? Not hypotheticals, that's a rhetorical question. So we'll have to leave that there. Anyway, we're down to the end of our time. We'll just go around. So, Rebecca, where can people go to learn more about the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association?
They can find us at pmta.org.
Outstanding. And, Steve, where can people go online to learn more about you and your group and the work that you're doing?
CommonwealthFoundation.org.
Okay. And, as always, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. And from Steve and Rebecca and me, thanks so much for listening. We will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
We are now nearing the midnight June 30th deadline for passage of a state budget, and once again, it is unlikely a new fiscal plan will be in place. It will be the fourth time in Governor Josh Shapiro's 4 years in office he has failed to get a budget through the legislature on time. Passage of a state budget has become the fiscal version of the iconic film Groundhog Day. Most years, when the sun dawns on July 1st, residents of Penns Woods awake to find state spending authority has lapsed. Such has been the case for decades, but it has recently happened more often. Governor Shapiro blames the partisan divide in the legislature. Democrats control the state House of Representatives, Republicans control the Senate. But for a governor whose self-adopted slogan is that he gets stuff done, he has been unable to deliver on the most important task of state government. Most Pennsylvanians suffer no consequences of a lapsed state budget, but for some, the impact is severe. Last year, the state endured a months-long budget impasse that put a financial squeeze on counties and school districts, some of which resorted to short-term borrowing and even layoffs to survive the disruption. Many nonprofits that provide human services also felt the effects of delayed state funding. In February, Governor Shapiro offered up a proposed state budget that calls for spending in excess of $5 billion more than projected revenue. He wants to drain the state's rainy day emergency fund to cover the deficit. He also relies on two sources of projected revenue, which do not currently exist, and which are unlikely to provide significant revenue in the coming fiscal year. In what Senate Majority Leader Joe Pittman of Indiana County termed a performative action, dutiful House Democrats passed the governor's proposed budget. Then, in an act of political jujitsu, they claimed the budget impasse is the fault of Senate Republicans. This, despite the fact everyone from the governor down to the most junior legislative backbencher knows the Shapiro-proposed House-passed budget is completely unrealistic. For the past 4 years, Senate Republicans have been the fiscal adults in the room. Of course, they are not about to agree to that level of unfunded spending. It doesn't take a degree in economics to understand that you cannot continue to spend $5 billion more each year than you receive in revenue. Draining the rainy day fund could get you through this year, not coincidentally, a year in which Shapiro stands for re-election, but then creates a gaping hole for every year thereafter. The state's independent fiscal office has already pointed out the obvious. Significant broad-based tax hikes will be necessary, beginning with the 2027-28 fiscal year, should the governor's TikTok-ready budget be approved. And so, we approach another budget deadline, with Democrats playing fiscal politics and Republicans trying to rein in the spending. This has become an annual charade, with Senate Republicans being partially successful at holding the line on spending. The Groundhog Day film was entertaining, but the yearly state budget wrangling has become tiresome. This raises the question as to why must we do this each year? Prior to the 1950s, state budgets were adopted for 2 years aligned with the 2-year legislative session. At the time, the advanced forecasting models we have today did not exist, so 1-year fiscal cycles made sense to allow the Commonwealth to more quickly adapt to changing fiscal tides. But is an annual fiscal cycle still necessary? The unique way the Pennsylvania legislature does business nurtures gridlock. Real negotiating and real decisions are made by a handful of legislative leaders. The only influence most members of the General Assembly have in the budget process comes in fleeting comments during caucus meetings. In the highly charged partisan atmosphere of Pennsylvania state government, a 2-year budget cycle is starting to make sense. If budgets are passed at the beginning of each 2-year legislative session, that would free lawmakers to focus more on long-term issues and planning. A 2-year budget cycle would provide some stability for both taxpayers and tax-funded organizations, with predictability in state taxation and spending. A 2-year cycle would also take budgeting out of election years, thus encouraging more serious proposals and minimize the political performances, such as we have seen from Governor Shapiro and House Democrats this year. It is an idea worth considering. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. For 31 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WFYL-AM in Jeffersonville, WVMM-FM in Grantham, along with WRVI-FM in Clearfield, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.